I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell, and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you so much for listening. We got a wonderful tweet from someone listened in Scotland, as anxious for us to do more Scots stories.
I think it was an email.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever it
was. We had an electronic communication.
I'm not very good at what they all are. But I think Scots stories are very interesting, partly because, of course, I was born in Scotland, on the Clyde in Greenock, and as was my mother. And so I'm very interested in Scottish crimes. Also, I'm fascinated by their different judicial system. I was having lunch yesterday with a Queen's Counsel who is works both in Scotland and in England. And we were talking about how very different the judiciary is in each country. So there's lots and lots of things to look at. For example, the Scots can pass a sentence of unproven, which is not the same as not guilty.
What does that mean?
It means the case hasn't been proven.
I've been putting the podcast emails in your file, in my filing, Dad, which is the wrong way round. I was trying to be professional and find the... Thank you, Nicola Schofield.
Schofield.
For emailing us about Scottish cases.
Yes, Nicola, thank you very much. I was very interested. And I will indeed put my mind to some Scottish stories. As I say, they lie close to my heart.
Other than Bible John, who is a so famous Scots?
Oh, there are all sorts. But the thing about the Scots justice system is that it tends to be quite parochial, whereas a big English crime, serial killer in England, will get national publicity, indeed worldwide publicity. Quite often in Scotland, the cases go almost unnoticed. I was once about to do a very good case for the Reader's Digest, this must have been 20 years ago, about a chap who killed his wife in Aberdeenshire. And it was barely reported in England. It was massively reported in Scotland. So it's a very interesting
something to look at.
Vain.
But they have such a lot of good Scottish detective stories.
They do. Taggart.
Rebus. I still think that we should do a fictional day, podcast, talking about all our favourite fictional detectives cases.
I've just reviewed a marvellous tartan noir writer called Alan Parks, who has invented a detective called Harry McCoy, and who is bleak as bleak can be. I mean, it makes Rebus look like a saint. But my goodness me, they're compelling. And they're so good. They're set in the 70s, which is a very clever idea. Set in this second book called February's Sun is set in the 1973 and is wonderful on the darkness of the Glasgow underworld and what was going on. And at the same time, against the background of the three-day week and all sorts of other political events. It's very, very good. His first book, Bloody January, I thought was excellent, but I think this one was even better, called February's Sun by Alan Parks. Marvellous. I mean, Scottish detectives have a tough old time.
A licence to be alcoholics.
Well, they're licensed to be gloomy. That would be true, wouldn't they? I don't think I've read a cheery Scottish detective. Mind you, I haven't read many, many cheery Yorkshire detectives or...
detectives, well, yeah, it's so often the case, isn't it? Like loner,
flawed.
On the spectrum, flawed, can't live with other people, yes. Vaguely antisocial.
Always has whiskey in the fridge.
Yeah. In the glove compartment.
There's a very good book too, which I also reviewed, called Gallows Tree Lane by a woman called Kate London, who was, funnily enough, in the Metropolitan Police's Homicide and Major Crime Unit. And she brings an authenticity to a police procedural, which is quite unusual in that She talks about what it's like to be a gay woman, what it's like to have a child by a senior officer and not let on. She's a single parent. Oh, it's very good. And it's also a very good case.
Tackling a lot of issues there.
Yeah, but it's very good. And it gives you a flavour of what it must be like in the world, as we now know, of undercover officers who go rogue and have children with people they're supposed to be investigating. It's such a grey, blurred area now. It's no longer them and us. We're all in it together. Mm. It's just a question of how much. And that's really what Alan Parks' books are about, how close the police and the criminals are and how they exist in the same melting pot.
That's true. We've touched on that before, haven't we?
We have. And there are a number of cases in which that's clearly true, in which there's been more involvement. Thankfully, today's is much more clear-cut. But although it does involve a policeman.
Oh, yeah. How's your week? Are you going to tell people what you've been up to?
I've been on Barry Island. Well, it's not perhaps quite correct to call it an island, but it's known as Barry Island. Making some more documentaries called Murder by the Sea, Series 3. Another 6 episodes in which I shot in an ice cream parlour, a fish and chip shop, an amusement arcade, a gift store, a caravan, and outside some very brightly painted holiday, beach huts.
Oh, very nice.
With a very wonderful Morris Minor from 1952, in which was tied to the top a series of very elderly suitcases.
What a scene setter.
Yeah. And we also did a new series opener, outside a place called the Beach Store, which had all manner of wonderful things, including blow-up unicorns and buckets and spades, and all extraordinary.
Who doesn't need a blow-up unicorn at this time of year?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a vital piece of equipment. There were various other rather odd things in it, but I don't think we should go into
that. That's even.
But it's I'm very lucky. I work with some very good people, and in the end, we have to laugh because it's so wonderfully bizarre. It's so bright. I mean, the director's determined to make it as bright as possible. He varies from two wonderful extremes. He either has everything very grim or everything incredibly bright. And this one was in the incredibly bright division.
Oh, well, why not?
The other thing that was funny is the first time in this series we did two with extras. Some in the ice cream parlour and some in the fish and chip shop. Now, that's great. And it makes the show look busy, no question of that. The trouble is the extras do tend to talk to each other. And I'm
while you're talking.
They have to mime talking when I'm talking. But the problem is, that I find, is keeping my concentration. Because the moment I stop and it's cut, off they go,
Chatty, chatty, chatty.
The moment say, okay, quiet on the set, and there I'm struggling sometimes to focus on it.
Not easy.
You can do it, but it just takes that little bit extra focus and effort. And then we were in this incredible caravan doing a wonderful story. But anyway, the new episodes of Murder by the Sea, the second series of 6 is finishing next week. But they're all on CBS Reality Catch-Up, I'm delighted to say, because I've been looking at them again just to check I'm not making a complete fool of myself. And the new ones will be around at about Easter.
Great. Well, that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, I think they've got a little hole in the schedule, as they say. And then there are rumours that we should be doing more Murder by the Sea.
Oh, well. We'll see.
We'll see. We do like to be beside the seaside, except it can be a bit cold. Can we do some in the summer? Can we go somewhere sunny?
Well, no, because that's not grim, is it?
No. Apparently, and it's very, very sweet, these people, walking their dogs or anything, come up to me and then they ask the crew, can we speak to him? Of course, don't be silly, It's so sweet, and we love your hat. And your coat.
Oh, well, everyone loves your hat and coat.
Yeah.
Today I'll take a picture of Jeffrey in his hat and coat and put it on our Instagram.
Well, that's what I thought we should really. We must do these sort of things more. I've got some very good snaps of this shoot.
Okay, well, we'll discuss later. We better press on.
We had.
And what name are we giving this person we're doing this week, Dad?
I think we should call it Stefano Brizzi, the Cannibal Killer. Stefano Brizzi was born in Tuscany, not very far from Florence. He was the third sibling of a devout Catholic family. His uncle, indeed, became a priest. He was a regular churchgoer, but found the Catholic religion more and more difficult to cope with as it became clear from his teenage years that he was basically gay. This did not fit in comfortably with his life in Italy and his family. Nevertheless, he was incredibly bright. He studied philosophy and computing in Florence, and indeed was recognized as being exceptionally talented web developer. He had a real eye and a nose and an instinct for it. His life proceeds uncomfortably because Italy is not necessarily the easiest of cultures in which to be a gay man. And tragically becomes HIV positive. And then gets hepatitis C. And these diagnoses happened finally, in 2008. He was born in 1967. So he's diagnosed with these dreadful diseases, which he regards as some kind of death sentence.
You can live with these now, though.
You can. And he was taking...
Very successfully.
Yeah, he'd been taking medication successfully for some time. But he had a very dark side. And he found it. He called it himself a death sentence. I think he was exaggerating. He was given to exaggeration. But in 2010, he was offered a job in London by the merchant bank Morgan Stanley, the big American investment bank, as a web developer with a salary starting at $50,000 and rising to $70,000 a year. He moved into a flat in a Peabody estate just south of London Bridge, which meant he could walk into work and could get to Canary Wharf very easily, and began to investigate what I suppose you would call the London drug culture. He was in his 40s. He was quite handsome. But for one reason or another, he started to take crystal meth, an extremely addictive drug, as you know. He also experimented with various other drugs, GHB, ketamine, what were known in that particular subculture as chems.
That is an interesting subculture.
Yeah, because it also involved him having what you might describe as chems parties.
Yeah.
With other gay men.
Yeah, that's quite intense. You can look that up if you don't know what that is, rather than us having to describe it.
Yes, it's let's put it this way. I'll leave it to your imagination.
It's a subculture.
Yeah. But quite a vivid one.
Yeah, no, it's very potent, almost
a
word.
Potent.
Yeah.
In every way.
Yeah.
Extremely potent. Mm. Well, Brizzi finds himself increasingly addicted to crystal meth. So much so that it almost blurs into his working life. He can't just keep it to the weekends. He is hooked in every way.
It's very, very addictive.
Very.
Yeah.
A warning to anyone, be very, 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 very wary.
That film Beautiful Boy is about that boy that gets addicted to crystal meth.
In February 2015, Brizzi, Stefano Brizzi, accepts the inevitable and resigns from his well-paid job and turns himself into a sort of night animal. He lives a nocturnal life. And he also inhabits the gay dating sites, but particularly Grindr. We have talked about Grindr before.
Stephen Port was on Grindr.
Stephen Port, the so-called Grindr killer. He also becomes addicted to a television program called Breaking Bad about drug dealers.
Very successful.
About a teacher who turns drug dealer and then drug lord.
You haven't watched that yet, have you?
No.
I bet you'd like it.
I would. Walter Whittle. Is that the name of the principal character? I think so.
I don't know the answer because I've not watched it, which is everyone would be cross with. I'm going to. I know that it's played by Bryan Cranston, though.
Yes. Well, Bryan Cranston now, of course, in Network on Broadway. The important point, really, is that
Walter White.
Walter White, I do beg your pardon, Walter White. That's the character in Breaking Bad, with whom Brizzi becomes fascinated
because he makes his own crystal meth in the show.
That's right.
Because I've seen the first episode, and he's a teacher, and he's in a sort of very unsuccessful marriage, and he finds out he's not well, and so he wonders how he's going to make money to look after his family. So he's a science teacher, so he cooks crystal meth.
And that's why Brizzi identified with him. He wanted
to make his own crystal
meth. But he also was most influenced by an episode in which White decides to kill off a rival by dissolving him in a bath of acid. Only problem is that the acid eats through the bath and the whole thing collapses. But Brizzi, in the way of a man who now lives an entire fantasy,
and whose brain is addled by drugs,
and his brain is completely fried by drugs, sees this as something natural. He also, because he's had some unhappiness in his life, downloads the Satanic Bible on his computer and convinces himself that he's hearing voices telling him he's got to kill. Now, I know for most people that would just sound ridiculous, but for a man who has a substantial crystal meth habit, likes chem parties or chem orgies, if you want to call it that, who is existing now in a totally twilight world, he barely goes out during the day, lives alone in a comparatively cramped flat, meeting people on Grindr. Well, it is a completely different world. It is literally an isolated world. And so, and I hesitate to say it, on the 1st of April 2016, and this is certainly no April Fool, he meets a serving Metropolitan Police Constable called Gordon Semple, who's 59 and originally from Inverness, on Grindr. He invites him round to his flat to take part in a party. He's meanwhile trying to raise other people. Gordon Semple, he's working, incidentally, Gordon, for the Westminster Anti-Social Behaviour Group, which is a slight irony, but never mind. Gordon is on duty. He's last seen at about 12:30, leaving the Shard in central London, where he's been having a meeting at the Shangri-La Hotel. Very grand, very lush, very five-star, very City of London. Gordon is seen on CCTV, much of which is available online, walking happily along through Blackfriars Station on his way to find Stefano Brizzi's flat on the south side of London Bridge.
I live near quite a lot of Peabody Estates in that area. Do you remember when I lived in Borough?
Yes, I do, very clearly. Mm. Yeah.
It... Sorry.
No, on the contrary.
Gordon's on his last seen CCTV on his way to
Britzy's flat. There can be very little doubt, although we do not know the precise details, that there was quite an elaborate sex game going on that afternoon in Britzy's flat. But for reasons we cannot be sure of, we do not know precisely at what point Britzy decided to kill Gordon Semple. We can probably pretty accurately time it.
You mean, was it premeditated or not?
I think it's a very, very difficult question to answer. I think it was premeditated in the sense that Britzy heard these voices telling him to kill. But I don't think it was premeditated. I don't think it was premeditated in the sense that he'd chosen specifically Gordon Semple as his target.
Mm-hmm.
They had never met. Britzy did not know, for example, that Semple was a police officer. He had no idea. He was simply a rather overweight man who had been in a full-time relationship for 25 years, but also liked sex with lots of other men at other times. He also liked...
Gordon's still married then?
Gordon was not married. He just had a permanent partner.
Okay.
And they lived in...
A lady partner?
No,
a male partner.
A male partner.
Oh, right, I see.
Yeah, he had a male partner, and they lived in Greenhithe near Dartford in Kent.
Okay.
But they was a quote, open relationship, because Semple clearly had all sorts of other lovers. In particular, Semple was attracted by domination and bondage. And one of the ads that Britzy put on Grindr suggested that this is something that he liked too. At one point... In the explanation of what happened, Britzy suggested that Semple had died in the midst of a sex game that went wrong when the dog's leash that he had round Semple's neck slipped and he ended up breaking his neck. I'm not sure it's true. I genuinely don't know. Did he strangle him? I don't know. We don't know. All we do know is that at about 7 o'clock that evening, about 7:05 on the 1st of April 2016, another man who decided he'd joined the chem party at Britzy's rang the buzzer to the flat near London Bridge in Southwark. And Britzy said, sorry, the party's cancelled. We've got a situation here. Someone's not too well, and we're sorting it. And the man went away.
Okay, so just to be clear, Gordon's finished his meeting at the Shard. He's going round to Britzy's. It's late.
Well, it's in the afternoon.
Oh, it's the afternoon.
It's the afternoon.
It's afternoon time. He said he's having a party. Is Gordon the only person in the house with Britzy at this time?
The only person.
Okay.
We should add, perhaps, that Britzy was, how can one put it, annoyed that the day before, on the 31st of March, a man had agreed to come round to his flat for the same kind of chem party and had stood him up, had never appeared. So it's about 7:05. I think it's probably abundantly clear that at that moment when the man rang the buzzer and the intercom and Britzy said, we've got a situation here, he was in the midst of killing Gordon Semple. A big chap, bigger than Britzy. Britzy was thinner by comparison. Round-faced, rather open-looking man. You wouldn't have seen him as in any way special. Britzy did look a little different. He had quite a full beard. He wore glasses.
That looks like an e-fit, but that's Jeffrey showing me a picture of him, and that's an actual picture.
No, it's. I think you'll find this is a court sketch.
Yeah, I can get a good sense of him. Yes,
yeah,
sort of.
I mean, he's fairly intense.
Fairly the Italian, handsome, yeah. Intense looking. Yeah.
Yeah, he's 50 years old by this point.
Hmm.
Gordon Semple clearly doesn't identify himself as a police officer, nor does he tell Brizzi that he's actually still on duty. This is just, quotes, a bit of fun on the side. Only doesn't turn out to be any kind of fun at all. Semple is killed by Brizzi. But that really isn't the point. That's tragic in itself. And in the wake of Gordon's death, the family relatives issued a heartbreakingly warm tribute to him and saying what a nice man he was and a great brother and brother-in-law and son and, you know, cousin and all that. Brizzi's family, by comparison, had no time for him. They would cast him into hell.
But they cast Brizzi to hell.
Cast Brizzi?
Yeah. Yes. They'd obviously done that already, hadn't they?
Pretty much, I think. He had separated completely from them. Okay. Brizzi is nobody's fool. And spurred on by Breaking Bad, he decides that he will dispose of Gordon Semple's body by dissolving it in acid. But not before he's cut it up. So he goes round to his local hardware store.
All of this is on CCTV, I bet.
There is some very, very interesting hardware store. It's CCTV of Leyland, the shop's called.
I know Leyland. There was one near my old work.
And he's seen examining this plastic bucket. Big plastic bucket. He buys buckets, he buys saws, he buys acid, he buys cleaner.
Surely when someone buys that, the staff are like, what are you using all this for?
999. Anyway, this wonderful, if you like that black humour, he's examining this really large pink bucket, which he purchases, and he returns to the flat. Now, how can I put it? Brizzi has lost contact with what you might describe as the real world. He's now living in a complete bubble, a fantasy. So he decides that he's going to dismember Gordon's body. So he cuts off bits of it off. For example, he cuts a foot off and throws it into the Thames, not far from London, you know, near London Bridge, where it's found by a passerby on the south bank.
This guy has seriously obviously got mental health issues, drug induced or otherwise, this point.
He cuts up all sorts of bits of Gordon, puts some of them in black bin bags. One black bin bag contains part of the spine, a pelvis. But no, it doesn't end there. He also decides that he's going to roast part of Gordon in the oven.
Ugh.
And he then decides to make
gross
smoothies.
No, come on.
In the blender.
No. Not for drinking.
Yeah. When the police finally examine the flat,
They spray that stuff everywhere and there's this luminol pink everywhere.
Absolutely. But not just that. They find Gordon's DNA in the blender, in the oven. They find human fat in the oven.
Ugh,
they also find...
That's so disgusting.
It is. They also find that Brizzi, for whatever reason, has decided to sample Gordon's flesh by cooking it and using chopsticks to eat it. We are talking about someone who clearly, clearly lost control of their senses.
So horrible.
Well, believe it or not, Brizzi is in command of his senses. He's dissolving large parts of Gordon in the bath with the acid, and he's putting other bits in. And when the police finally arrive at his door, exactly the same as Dennis Nielsen, when the police finally arrived at Dennis Nielsen's door and said, "Mr. Nielsen, we've come to talk to you about the drains," it was because of the smell.
Oh, yeah.
And in the end, it was Brizzi's neighbours who complained to the police that there was a terrible smell coming out of his flat. Well, it's not surprising. Gordon had been in there for 5 days.
Yuck.
Putrefying, being dismembered,
cooked,
bathed in acid, cooked, roasted,
blended.
You know, we are talking about Hannibal Lecter, really, aren't we? With a nice Chianti.
Yeah, but Hannibal Lecter's much more like premeditated and
he's
focused.
But we are nevertheless, that's why it's fair to call him a cannibal.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean. So
eventually,
sorry,
the police arrive at his front door.
And just to check, basically, if you go on an app, they can just find where you went and who you were talking to once you've gone missing, can't they? So it can't have been super hard to find Mr. Brissy.
No, in fact, Gordon wasn't reported missing until the morning of the 2nd of April, when his partner phoned the police and said he hasn't come back.
Okay.
And when the police arrive at Stefano Brizzi's apartment, it's the 6th of April, so only 4 days have elapsed. But they don't go there because of the app.
They go there because of the smell.
They go there because of the smell. Brizzi, who by this time I'm sure has lost all control of his senses, opens the door wearing a pair of pink underpants and aviator sunglasses. And the first thing he says to the policeman at the door, "I've tried to dissolve the body. I've killed a police officer. I killed him last week. Satan told me to."
I wonder what you say to that.
I'm not sure what the officer said. It's really is mind-boggling. Here's a man in his 50s or 50, had a good job, became addicted to crystal meth and killed a police officer while he was on duty, even though he was participating in a sex game, okay, but something has clearly gone very badly wrong. He makes an admission, then he tries to change his story. So Brizzi tries to say, no, it was an accident and, he died and then I didn't know what to do and so I decided, why not call an ambulance or the police? You don't go round to the local DIY store and buy saws, buckets, acid and the rest, do you? I mean, it may not have been premeditated, but it was certainly post-meditated.
True.
He goes to that. Of course, he's tried to clean up bits of the flat, but the luminol immediately reveals vast amounts of blood everywhere.
Yeah, of course. We talked about this before. It's very impractical to dismember somebody.
It's very...
Especially a fat person.
Yes, and he was. Gordon wasn't, if you look at the CCTV, for example, he's been going through back.
Just larger, person. So I don't
he's
mean
a large,
that.
Large man, yes. That wouldn't be unfair to call him that. Not surprisingly, Brizzi insists at the trial in December 2016 that he was... innocent of it all. It was a sex game that went wrong. He then didn't know what to do. He's closely cross-examined, not least about the DNA found all around his flat and the stuff that he bought at the DIY store, including a perforated metal sheet on which clearly to lay Gordon's body out.
Not a metal sheet.
Yeah, metal sheet. Big metal sheet, which he thought, I presumably, was to protect the carpet.
Oh, yeah, I would have just gone for like a more tarpaulin-y style.
Absolutely, and that plastic polythene.
Yeah, that's the one, polythene.
But they found, of course, the police found parts of Gordon, body parts in the bath. And indeed, Brizzi told the original officers that he thought he was getting away with it because he was only a day away from getting rid of all the rest of the body.
Yeah, Brizzi.
The court was played a video of a police interview in which Brizzi can be heard saying, "Oh, as you can see, this man was a very big man, and all I have is left is two buckets." So there's a kind of Brizzi admits to trying to dissolve the body of the policeman because Satan told me to. He also told the jury that Semple died in a state of erotic bliss. If anything could be more disgusting. He told them that he'd chucked some of Gordon's body into the Thames and thrown away his police badge. The jury, at his trial at the Old Bailey, took 5 whole days to decide that he was guilty. They didn't come back in 2 hours.
Could you, can you like plead diminished responsibility for drug addiction?
You could, but in fact, Stefano didn't choose that defence. Many other people we've talked about have gone for the diminished responsibility defence. You know, I was out of my mind. It was a crime of passion. But it is true that the judge, who happened to be the recorder of London, asked for some more details on the bite marks that had been discovered on Gordon's rib. The police identified the marks as having been made by Breitz's teeth. They were very specific bite marks.
Yuck.
And that influenced his decision as to the sentence after the jury had come back.
What was he sentenced to?
Life with a minimum of 28 years. This was in December 2016.
Where is he?
He was sent to Belmarsh. He'd been in Belmarsh, where he'd been investigated and analysed by a psychiatrist. In fact, a number of psychiatrists.
Is Belmarsh a secure facility?
High security prison in southeast London. Oh. HMP Belmarsh. A lot of terrorists there. He was a Category A prisoner. And during some of his interviews, before the trial, he made a noose out of, plaited a noose. And psychiatrist talked to him about this. And he said, no, I was bored and I've got this trial coming up. And that's fine. But the end of the story is perhaps fitting. On Sunday, the 5th of February, 2017, barely 8 weeks after his sentence, Breitz hanged himself in Belmarsh. He'd been taken off suicide watch a month earlier because he presented as participant, wanted to train in various programs, but clearly his mind was profoundly disturbed. He amended his will 2 days before his suicide. I have written before about the possibility of very long sentences being almost more horrific than the hangman. I have no way of knowing what Stefano Breitz's cast of mind was when he ended his life in February 2017. What I do know is that there will be some in the prison system who will say he saved us a great deal of money and he didn't deserve to live. Just as there will be others who will say we should have treated him differently, we should have said he was mad and not bad. What I think is interesting about this case is it throws into high relief a lot of moral issues. It's the drug addiction, the fantasy world, the satanic Bible.
Or the being gay and feeling that that wasn't acceptable due to religion.
Yeah, being gay in
cultural.
Italy. Cultural problems. The gay dating scene.
Yeah.
You know,
anything of being repressed or suppressed or that sort of thing. It's not good for one.
Yeah.
Look at the Victorians.
The senior investigating officer in the case, Detective Chief Superintendent Peter Ealing, said afterwards that Breitz had gone to sickening lengths to dispose of Semple. Quote, and I quote him, Breitz clearly and coldly laid a false trail by contacting Gordon on Grindr 5 days after he himself had murdered him and weaving a fictitious account of what took place that afternoon. Breitz was unaware that Gordon was a police officer, the Detective Chief Superintendent went on, and the investigation has proved that the two men had never met before. Only Breitz will know the reasons why that day he became a killer. The superintendent went on, sadly, it's clear from the investigation that Gordon, a man who dedicated the last three decades of his life to policing London, was behaving on duty in a way that no police officer should. Gordon held a position of trust, and he broke that trust. However, nothing should distract from the actions of Stefano Brizzi, and the blame for Gordon's death lies firmly with this man, a killer whose cold, calculated actions are so grotesque they are beyond comprehension.
Well, well put.
And I think as a fitting epitaph.
A fitting end. Thanks, Dad. That was really interesting. I didn't know anything about Brizzi. Jeffrey called me in the middle of the week and said, this is who we're going to do if you want to look it up. And I thought, I'm not going to look that up.
I don't entirely blame you for that. Yeah. I think that the suicide is a particularly apt coda.
His brain was all messed up. He was all squiggly. Like, once you've got that squiggly, it's hard to unravel.
Anyway, let's conclude with something much more glamorous and fun.
Oh, well, just officially to say thank you, that's the end of Stefano Brizzi, the cannibal
killer.
Yes, thanks, Dad. Glamorous. BAFTAs this weekend.
The film BAFTAs.
The film BAFTAs.
And which you're going to lots of things.
I'm going to a few things, true, including the BAFTAs.
Including BAFTA itself. Where is it this year? Is it Drury Lane again?
It's Royal Albert Hall now.
Oh, it's Royal Albert Hall now. Okay.
Yeah. And for fun, I'm going to read out the nominees for the for Best Leading Actress, Best Actor, Best Director. Supporting, do you want the four acting categories, and Best Director and Best Film?
That's it. Let's do the six.
Right. We're going to do the six. I'm going to read them out. Jeffrey's going to guess. I'm not going to guess. Jeffrey's going to guess. And then we'll be able to tot up in 2 weeks.
2 weeks' time, you can tell me whether I was right or wrong many I got wrong or right.
Okay. Right. Hold on a second.
I am.
Best film.
Yep.
Black Klansman. The Favourite. Green Book. Roma. Or A Star Is Born.
Well, BAFTA will want to give it to The Favourite because of Olivia Colman, but I think they might give it to Green Book.
Interesting. Green Book is going down very well. Black Klansman is a lot of people. I haven't seen it, but people have been chatting about.
Yeah.
Roma, obviously. It's on Netflix. Have you watched it?
I haven't watched it yet. I'm about to. Funny enough, the director I was working with this week said he liked it very much.
And A Star Is Born, fourth version of...
Can't see it.
Not going to give it to Brad?
Don't see it.
Jeffrey's going for Green Book then, by proxy, are you?
I'm going to go for Green Book, although BAFTA will want to give it to The Favourite because of Olivia Colman.
They might give The Favourite to Outstanding British Film.
Could do.
You never know.
Never mind.
Okay, Best Actress. Glenn Close for The Wife, Lady Gaga for A Star Is Born, Melissa McCarthy, Can You Ever Forgive Me, Olivia Colman, The Favourite, or Viola Davis for Widows. I mean, that's a slam dunk, isn't it?
Olivia.
Olivia Colman. Don't even think about it. Best Leading Actor. Bradley Cooper, A Star Is Born, Christian Bale, Vice, Rami Malek, Bohemian Rhapsody, Steve Coogan, Stan and Ollie, Viggo Mortensen, Green Book. You think Rami Malek?
I do.
Do you?
For Bohemian Rhapsody.
Interesting. I feel like Vice apparently is really good.
Maybe. Yes, and it's a wonderful performance. It's a transforming performance. I mean, it'll look a bit like Dick Cheney.
No, I know, I know.
Wonderful, wonderful piece of makeup.
I know. You know, you put on like 40 pounds.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, Best Supporting Actress, Amy Adams for Vice, Claire Foy for First Man, Emma Stone for The Favourite, Margot Robbie for Mary Queen of Scots, or Rachel Weisz for The Favourite.
One of the two favourites. Rachel Weisz, probably.
Yeah. They're both very good in it. I've heard Amy Adams also very good in that book. But yeah, probably one of the favourite ladies. Best Supporting Actor. Adam Driver for Black Klansman. Maharaja Ali for Green Book. Richard E. Grant for Can You Ever Forgive Me? Sam Rockwell for Vice? Or Timothée Chalamet for Beautiful Boy?
The black actor whose name I can never pronounce.
Maharaj Ali.
For Green Book.
Yeah, I agree. And then, what was the other one to do? Best Director.
Yeah.
Best Director. Spike Lee for Black Klansman. Pavel Pavlovsky for Cold War. Yorgos Lanthimos for The Favourite. Alfonso Cuarón for Roma. Bradley Cooper, Star is Born.
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah, I think so too. Interesting. Interesting. Okay, well, we'll see. We'll see. I'll be there. I'll be texting you live.
you'll be texting me live. That's good to hear.
Yeah, I'll be updating you live.
Well done. Well, we'll only be watching it on the, you know, the BBC, won't we? We'll watch it on Sunday night.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. I think the Oscars in a couple of weeks will be equally interesting.
Yeah, too. Yeah, it'll be good.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. But it's nice you're going to a party or two and you're going to the event itself.
Yeah, so. It'll be good.
That's lovely. Very nice. I've got nothing nearly as exotic as that. after the fish and chip shop on Barry Island, I mean...
You've reached the heights of exotic. So
I've got reached the heights
you've got
of
nowhere to go.
Truly exotic. Actually, I've got a great deal of time for Barry Island. It's wonderful. It's where they filmed Gavin and Stacey with James Corden.
I know, we talked about it last time.
You know, so every shop has a sign up saying they shot Gavin and Stacey here. You know, you can't go into a shop without it written. You know.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I might as well make the most of it.
And there's a man who does tours, Gavin and Stacey tours, with a special bus.
As I said before, previously on the podcast, Gavin and Stacey is an excellent, excellent television programme.
Yes. Well, darling.
With a very good cast.
I wish you a wonderful week.
Thanks, Dad. You too.
And I think it's great fun. You're not much of a weekend off this for you. It's not really a weekend off at all. It's a weekend on.
Yes, weekend on.
Full on.
Full on. Full on, full on.
There's okay. The ceremony and then there's a party after the...
Well, you have the ceremony and then you have the dinner and then you have the parties. So you don't get home before 2 or 3.
And do you go on Monday? Is there other stuff on Monday?
No, that's it.
I should think that's enough.
Yeah.
Crikey.
It's a lot.
A lot would be the word.
It's a lot.
Well, have a wonderful time.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening again. We should just give a couple of name checks.
Oh, yes. Poppy, Damon, our producer, thank you very much.
To my son and Molly's brother, Dan Wansel.
And that's the music.
Music.
And my friend George Lee, who drew the cartoon, or caricature, rather.
Caricature.
And all of you for writing in.
Yes, more the merrier. I'm going to do more Twitter, because I've been shouted at by my television producers for not being accessible enough. So I've got to do more stuff.
Ramp up your social media,
we've got
Dad.
We've got a Twitter account for the Blood Ties, haven't we?
Yeah, we have a Blood Ties _pod.
And we've also got...
We've got Instagram, which I'm going to take charge of. So I'm going to post some stories up there. We might film some in a second when we finish this.
Yeah, okay.
And you can email us, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com.
Thank you again for listening.
Take care.